I'm very happy now to welcome Steve Macnick. He is the director of the Laboratory of Behavioral Neurophysiology at the Barrow Neurological Institute, and Susana Martinez Conde, who's the director of the Laboratory of Visual Neuroscience at the same place, and Sandy Blakesley, who is science writer for the New York Times and author of many books on science and neuroscience in particular. And they are co-authors of the book Sleights of Mind: What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks.
So this is a book about the science of how magicians basically hack our brains to do utterly believable and inscrutable magic tricks. And the first question I have for you is, what do the illusions of magic tricks show us that the straightforward study of perception doesn't show us?
Well, I would say that magicians actually manipulate attention and awareness better than scientists do, at least right now, because they've been developing their techniques over hundreds of years or millennia, whereas cognitive neuroscience is only 30 or 40 years old. So they have a big advantage, and they haven't been using the scientific method, but they've nevertheless been doing systematic analysis of the human mind and behavior for so long that they really have the edge on us scientists, and we realized this very early that we need to learn those techniques in order to increase the rate of discovery in science. For example, one of the illusions that we have that's very powerful can only be used once, whereas magicians do similar things, but their tricks are robust, so they can do them over and over and over on the same group of people and night after night, and they nevertheless work. And so that's the kind of thing that they have on us that we need to learn how to do as well in the lab.
What are some of the assumptions and the tools that they use to manipulate us?
Well, they use a lot of different mechanisms of illusion to manipulate. They will misdirect the attention. They will use visual and optical illusions. They will lead the spectator to believe that they're making choices that they feel are free choices, whereas in reality they are predetermined choices by the magician. They will implant false memories. So they do all of these things. There are all of these layers of complexity, oftentimes in just a relatively simple magic trick.
When you started looking at this, first you look at an illusion, you look at a magic trick, you have no idea how they do it. Then you figure out how they do it, they tell you, and you understand it. At that point, are you able to see it when they do it, or are they just too good? I mean, does the illusion carry through even when you know how it's done?
Well, it depends on the type of trick that it is. So, for example, the types of tricks that we're really interested in are ones that manipulate our cognition. So they're actually manipulating our attention or our awareness or our memory or one of our cognitive systems. And these tricks, they actually are a type of mental jiu-jitsu. That is, they're using our normal brain processes that we already have and that we use all the time, and they're using it against us. So, for example, when we pay attention to something, one of the things that we're doing is suppressing everything else that we're not paying attention to. So certainly you've had someone who's having a daydream, and you're trying to talk to them, and they can't hear you because they're so ensconced in their daydream that they can't hear you until you tap on their shoulder and get their attention. And that's the kind of thing magicians are doing, because they're getting you to pay attention to the right hand while they do something secret in the left hand, and they're using your own powers of concentration to suppress their secret move. So that's the fundamental thing that they're doing.
Even while they're doing it, you get flummoxed every time. You can't catch them. They're so good. People like Teller. In this book, we worked with some of the greatest magicians in the country and even overseas. And you could watch it again and again and again and never catch them. Whereas more amateurs, you do catch them.
And another thing to say is that some of the tricks, though, are done with gimmicks. And gimmicks are not interesting to the mind. They're basically artificial things that make a card disappear, for instance, with a device. And if you know how that trick works, then it's ruined forever. You know, there's nothing interesting in the brain about that. It's a very cool magic trick, but if you understand the secret, then it doesn't work. But even if you understand how these attentional tricks work, you may have an idea of how they must have done it, but they could have used 1 in 10 methods, and you don't know what it is. So even other magicians are often fooled by great magicians' tricks if they're the kind that use the neural methods.
So give us an example. I mean, obviously this is radio and we can't show it, but give us an example of a magic trick that taught you something about neuroscience that you didn't know before.
Well, we heard of this magic trick by one of our magic collaborators, Apollo Robbins, the gentleman thief. He's a magician who specializes in pickpocketing. In fact, he became really renowned when some years back he was able to pickpocket the Secret Service detail of ex-President Jimmy Carter. And he told us that he realized that there were two different types of motions that he used in magic and when pickpocketing, that would be like a curved motion or a straight motion, and he could use them, for instance, to steal objects or to make objects disappear in different situations and with different outcomes. And that in our collaboration, we identified that the reason why these two different types of movements work in different ways is because they activate different types of oculomotor behavior. So you produce these two different types of eye movements in both situations, for the curved motion and for the straight motion, and that goes a long way towards explaining the different perceptual results that you achieve in the magic performance. And this is something that was completely unknown to neuroscience.
There's one other thing that he did too. Apollo talked about getting into peripersonal space,
yeah,
which is an entire field in neuroscience, and he intuited this, and he has a way of sidling up to people, and he would duck into their space and to gain their trust and then be able to pickpocket them. But that is, you know, relying on a very fundamental neuroscience finding.
And it's also a kind of it's just a psychological thing. When somebody comes straight at you, you're going to have a different perception of them than if they come up to the side of you, which is much less threatening.
He sneaks in.
Yeah. We're talking about the book Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. So you basically entered this world of magic, so people who practice magic tend not to tell their tricks. How are you able to get people to share their magic tricks in the first place?
Well, in the field of magic, magicians are actually very free about information to other magicians. What they don't want is they don't want to give information to somebody who didn't want to know about it before. So when you know, in the ethical guidelines for the various magical associations that we're now members of as budding magicians ourselves, these ethical guidelines denote that you have to be careful to not allow somebody to learn secrets that they didn't want to know, and especially to learn them by accident because you did a trick poorly. There are 78,000 magic books in Amazon as compared to 12,000 in romance, and that's because people are interested in learning about the magic tricks and how they work, and that's all well and good. And the president of the Magic Circle in England, he says it best when he says that the doors to magic are closed, but they're not locked. So if you want to know what the secrets are, then you basically have to make the effort to go find them out, and you can find out anything you want. Nobody will keep it from you if you really want to become a magician and learn how to do these. But they don't want anybody finding out anything that they didn't really want to find out, because it'll just they're worried it'll degrade the magic.
You know, one thing about when we search this book, you can find every magic trick on YouTube. It's amazing. And a lot of times,
including the explanations?
Not necessarily the explanations, but there's 7-year-olds in their bedroom with their dad holding the camera up, and they're doing the dinner roll trick, and they're making coins disappear. And they're bad at it, but it's all the tricks are there. There's nothing that we couldn't find on YouTube. So it's out there.
Now, there's a trick which involves balls and cups. And traditionally, this trick has always been done in such a way that the cup is opaque and the balls that go in and out of it, and you create all sorts of illusions and do sleights of hand and stuff. Penn and Teller started to do it with transparent plastic cups, and they were so good that it still worked.
That's right. You know, you can't get, in fact, Teller did that, and he surprised himself. He was so fast and so deft that he decided to just do it with the plastic cups.
And the illusion still holds,
still
even
holds.
Though you can actually see him putting a new ball into a place where it wasn't before or whatever.
He loads the cup, but you can't catch him.
You look, but you don't see.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the ways in which these tricks or some of the moments in which they don't work. There was this moment where you, Susanna, were sick to your stomach and you were not paying attention to the illusion of the trick, but you were still watching it, but you were feeling nauseated, and you saw very clearly what the guy was doing. So in a way, well, how does that work? What's going on psychologically, neurologically?
Well, the magician needs to have the spectators focus their attention. It's magicians and neuroscientists as well refer to the spotlight of attention, and that basically means that you have a strong attentional focus, and the magician is able to manipulate it and redirect it and manage it in the way that is most convenient for the perception of the trick, of the magical effect. And that what happened with me is that I was experiencing all day morning sickness at the time, so my spotlight of attention was really very diffused, and that not concentrating on the magical performance, but concentrating on not trying to puke. So what happened during this demonstration, and it was a demonstration by a master magician, really a real virtuoso of magic, but I was basically trying to see if I could excuse myself and leave the room without being noticed when I saw this flash of yellow that finally caught my attention, and I looked to see, and I was able to catch the magician stuffing a lemon under a handkerchief. And later on in the performance, when he revealed, he pulled out the handkerchief and there was a lemon underneath, everybody was amazed because they hadn't been able to see it because they were paying attention. And so the magician had been able to manipulate their attentional focuses in a way that they wouldn't see the secret move. And this is also the reason why a lot of magicians have told us that children are generally not very good subjects for magic. They're not good magic audiences, and there's a threshold, which is a minimum age of 5. And for children younger than 5, what happens with them is that they don't have a strong focus of attention, and so that makes the magician's job much more difficult.
What about other people? Are there some groups you write about, for example, autistic people? I was wondering also about visual artists who are extremely visually oriented and have different kinds of perceptions than the rest of us. Do they perceive or see through magic in a different way?
I'm not aware that a study has been done with visual artists per se, but I can tell you that already a couple of hundred years ago, some studies were done to determine if magicians themselves had superior perceptual abilities compared to the rest of us mere mortals. And the answer is that they don't. A magician who is trained may be able to know intellectually what's happening, what the secret method is, what the secret move, but that doesn't mean that their perception is any different from the rest of us.
Sandy, what about cultural differences? Have you studied at all, or has it been studied how magic works on people from extremely different cultures?
Well, I think we were talking this earlier. I think Chinese magicians can fool Americans, and American magicians can fool Chinese, and so people that live in urban environments or in advanced cultures or even not so advanced cultures, certainly the magic tricks would work because we all have the same brain structures. But wonder whether somebody in the Kalahari Desert or somebody that had a completely different set of attentional experiences, whether or not they would be fooled. I don't know. I don't think anybody's ever studied that, but it's an interesting question.
Tell us about, Sandy, the neurophysiology of being manipulated by a con man.
Oh, yeah, the trust. There's a guy named Paul Zak who we interviewed, and he says that what magicians, or what con men do, like Bernie Madoff, is to schmooze up to you and to make you trust them, make you like them, and it releases oxytocin, which is a neurohormone that's the love hormone. But that's what the con men are doing very, very well. They have various techniques for that, but they're, you know, milking your oxytocin circuits.
Can you tell an example of that?
Paul talks about when he was a kid, he was working in a gas station, and he was approached by a guy saying, "Oh, I just found this necklace," he just fooled him into giving him $100. Paul gave the guy $100, and in his greed, o-meter went off, and he was feeling sorry for the guy because he had to go away to help his wife, and it was a long story, but he got his oxytocin going, and the guy never showed up, and Paul lost his money, and that's when he sort of realized that the trust is being engendered by these guys.
And magicians do the same thing.
Yes, they do.
Now, I imagine I don't think they probably work anymore, but originally that's what those Nigerian spam scams were all about.
That's right. That's right.
We're talking about the book Sleights of Mind. So, Stephen and Susanna, you have become magicians yourselves and passed through some very difficult auditions to become, I don't think you want to be professional musicians as your professional neuroscientist, but you've gone much further than probably you expected to. What has that process been like? Tell us about it.
Well, when we first started deciding to do this, we realized that we really had to learn magic ourselves in order to understand it well enough to design experiments with it. So designing an experiment is actually a quite complicated task, and you really can't do it unless you understand completely the stimulus that you are creating and what you at least have hypotheses for what the effects are going to be. So we knew that we had to learn magic well enough to do that, and basically at the professional level. And so we trained for about a year to become magicians, and very intensely in the last 3 months of that year, because we decided that to prove it to ourselves that we had the chops to be professional magicians, that we would audition at the Magic Castle in Hollywood, which is the premier club for magicians in the world. And you have to audition in front of a number of famous and sometimes world famous magicians, as was the case with us. We had 9 to 10 very famous people on our committee, and we performed for them a parlor act, and we were very actually disappointed in the middle of our act when one of the magicians said, "Okay, I've seen enough," and the other ones were like, "Yeah, we've seen enough too," and so they summarily dismissed us in the middle of our act. And we went upstairs to the bar and started to imbibe and to consider what we'd done wrong, because we thought we had been doing a pretty good job, and were surprised that we were dismissed. And later we were happy because one of the head of the committee came up and started to explain to us the rules of the club, and we were confused. And he said, "Oh, no, it's we summarily dismissed you because you had shown confidence and there was no need to see any more," and we had several other people to audition that night. So that's why we do half of our act. So it was it was about as scary as doing your thesis defense for a PhD. It was quite an event.
That's very funny, because there's really, really not that much riding on it.
Right.
PhD.
No, exactly. But still, you put so much time and effort into these things, and you know, they made it very clear that that we shouldn't quit our day jobs, you know.
It was intimidating. I mean, these were professional magicians that we knew about, that really big names in magic. And so you perform in front of them with your, your little practice that you've managed to put in the free time outside of the laboratory, and you don't want to make a fool of yourself. But they were very nice, actually. It was a fun experience.
So Stephen Zenner used a lot of humor in that. And another thing that magicians do is to disarm you with humor, and that's a key component to their armamentarium tricks.
Yes, something that we're very interested both in our research and that in the implications for everyday life is how emotion and attention interact. And that one of the magicians that we've worked with, Johnny Thompson, the great Tom Sonny, he says that when the audience laughs, time stops, meaning that then the magician can do anything. The magician can get away with magical murder because the attention is focused on their own emotions rather than what's happening in front of them. And that so they use a humor to distract attention, but also to generate empathy and to stimulate these oxytocin circuits that Sandy was talking about. And this is also something that we should really take notice and use in our everyday life, that it pays to try to be empathic and to use humor if possible, just in general to do as a magician and disarm with charm.
Especially if you want something from somebody else or you want to fool them.
That's right.
It works. So you have started a contest which has been going on for some years now called Best Illusion of the Year Contest. Tell us about that.
So the Best Illusion of the Year Contest is a celebration of the community of artists and scientists who create visual illusions that we can all enjoy. If you don't know what a visual illusion is, go to illusionoftheyear.com, and you'll see all of the illusions that have made it to the top 10 in the last 6 years, of which they're just amazing. And illusions are really important to neuroscience, and because they represent stimuli in which the physical reality doesn't match the perception. And if you think about what we are as humans, you'll realize that what we really are is a bunch of electrochemical signals going around through circuits in our brains, and that those electrochemical signals only get information from our sensory systems through nerves that connect to our eyes and our ears and our skin, et cetera. And the brain takes all that sparse, rather poor information and builds this amazing simulation of the world around us so that we can interact with it through the simulation. And even though it's simulated, we're not saying that the world outside isn't there. It is, but you've never lived there. You've never even been there for a visit. And so what's happening is that this simulation that the brain creates for us is really the fabric of the universe that we live in. And so by studying that fabric of that universe, we are doing the same thing as high-energy physicists are by studying electrons. We're finding out what the fundamental ways the universe works is. And visual illusions are great because they show very clearly how it is that the brain is doing one thing despite the physical reality. And so it allows us to press against that fabric and really understand what it's made of. And so the contest is a way to promote vision research and the illusion community that creates these illusions to the public.
Now, do you think that the two of you as neuroscientists have an edge as magicians? Are you able to bring things in there that the rest of the magician community doesn't know?
Evidently not, I would say, based on how good we are.
We come from a different perspective. A number of magicians have told us that we have gotten interested in magic, we're sort of coming from the side, from this lateral approach in that even before we started learning any magic ourselves, we knew a lot about how attention works in the brain, what the underlying neural circuits are, and how attention can be generally manipulated. So we were able to understand at a theoretical level a number of concepts about misdirection and management of attention that for a lot of magicians, this only comes in a number of years into their training because they're starting from the bottom. But, of course, our finger dexterity is really beginner's level.
Stephen Macnick, And Susana Martinez-Conde and Sandy Blakesley are co-authors of the book Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.